good afternoon to you, everybody. Thank you very much for joining us. Have you found yourself a nice big ice block to sit on this afternoon? I think that would really feel good, wouldn't it? Stan Turner with you here. Thank you very much. We'll try to cool things off for you a little bit. You know, I was checking out with our favorite climatologist, Mark Seeley, over at the University of Minnesota Extension Service. Mark has written a book called Minnesota Weather Almanac, and he notes, get this, it sounds unbelievable, but it's true. Minnesota is one of the few places on the face of this planet that has a large temperature spread almost second to none. We have a range of temperatures 175 degrees. We have registered 115 degree heat some years ago, minus 60 below zero for a spread of 175 degrees. That, folks, that's crazy. That's nuts. Right now, well, we've got 84 degrees. That's not too crazy. We're going to 93. It's getting a little crazier as the afternoon unfolds, though. We'll have a heat index in the upper 90s today, a high of 93 air temperature, but combined with the humidity, it's going to be very uncomfortable out there. So the name of the game is go slow, take it easy, listen to the show, and cool off. I think we have a real winner for you today. This show. Well, today's jungle-like weather might seem familiar to some of you who have visited Vietnam, either as a tourist or as a soldier. Vietnam, for many, it's an emotion more than a place name. I remember a few summers ago walking around Duluth on a late August day. The shops were clearing out their summer merchandise, and I spotted a nice sports shirt with an even nicer price tag, a real steal. So I bought it. Back at the hotel room, I took the shirt out of the bag and only then noticed that the manufacturer's tag read, Made in Vietnam. That really hit me. Yes, the war was long ago, and the U.S. had since established trade relations with Vietnam. But looking at that label, Made in Vietnam, really troubled me. What had that war really been about? What about all our soldiers who fought and died or were wounded physically or psychologically or both, and the lousy reception that many got when they returned home? Was it all so that I, three or so decades later, could buy a nice shirt at a nice price made in that country that represented so much misery to so many of my fellow Americans? Well, the South Vietnamese city of Saigon fell in the spring of 1975, and that marked the end of the active American military action there. That was more than 40 years ago. But in the minds and the bodies of those who served there, the war is not really over, probably never will be. Many Minnesotans are among that number, and they are being remembered, in fact honored, with a new exhibit at the Minnesota Military Museum, the one at Camp Ripley near Little Falls in central Minnesota. Many of you have visited there, and I hope many more of you do. The exhibit is called Minnesota Voices from the Vietnam War. The guy who helped put it together, really the leading force, is museum curator Doug Becky. Doug is with us in studio this noon. Doug knows more than a little something about the Vietnam War. He was in it. He was a special forces soldier. And we also have the privilege of hearing from another Vietnam vet this noon, Paul Clark, U.S. Marine Corps. And he has authored a book with a very interesting title, Letters Never Written. Wow, we'll be delving into that one. Paul, Vietnam weather outside today, huh? A little bit?
Oh, my gosh, it's hot and humid.
Yeah.
And I can remember one of the first things we did in Vietnam was to get rid of our underwear and start to just wear T-shirts.
Really, huh?
Yep. The underwear became kind of cumbersome.
Wow.
And bunched up, and so most of the guys just threw it out.
Wow. Didn't take us long to get into underwear, Doug Becky, did it? the weather familiar to you, huh?
Yeah. Well, I didn't wear a T-shirt, but I wore my underpants.
Anyway, the war is a long time ago, but it's right in front of us right now. Doug, let's begin by just kind of setting the stage before we get into your exhibit, Minnesota Voices from the Vietnam War. As far as Minnesota participation in it, we really don't have an accurate account of how many Minnesotans served in the military during the Vietnam War years, but we sure know about the those who were killed in action.
Yes, there were 1,072 Minnesotans who died in the Vietnam War.
And what about wounded and missing? Do we have any handle on that?
I don't have that number.
Okay.
I don't have
all right. That number. And folks, you should know there is a Vietnam War memorial on the Capitol approach in St. Paul. Can you describe that for us, Dougie, even?
Well, there's several of them. One of them that up. The one I'm most familiar with was done by a Minnesota artist named Roger Brodeen.
Yeah.
And it's called, I think, Testament to the Living. Mm-hmm. And it's about a 12-foot-high Vietnam soldier standing with his arms out, mm-hmm. kind of in a questioning manner.
Mm-hmm.
And Roger's intent was to have him staring directly at the Capitol.
Mm-hmm.
So
there's some symbolism in that, isn't
there?
Huh?
That's right. Yeah.
You politicians pay heed, maybe, huh?
Yeah.
Remember us for sure. Yes, yes. Paul, what year did your years, let's see, Marine Corps, unlike the other branches of service, you guys did, what, 13 months for
we
a tour?
We did 13 months. Yeah. The Marine Corps got to do just one more than the other branches of the service. And so, yeah, we were over there for 13 months. I was there primarily in 1968.
68. Well, all those years were bad. Was that the year of the Tet Offensive?
I landed in Dong Ha,
yeah.
North Vietnam, during the Tet Offensive. And they were taking incoming in the landing area, and somebody grabbed my elbow and said, Lieutenant, come here. Jump in the bunker. I had no idea what was going on with the roar of the engines and everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was my welcome to Vietnam.
Welcome to Vietnam. You had really no idea what was going on. You didn't even have a weapon, did you? You didn't have a rifle, huh?
It was kind of disconcerting.
Kind
here
of,
we
huh?
are, we're in Vietnam, and I wasn't issued a weapon, and I didn't know where to go, and people were picking you up, and I'm wondering, what if somebody attacks? Do I have to shoot back, and how am I going to do this?
So, just yell at them, I guess.
throw rocks.
Doug Becky, yeah, throw rocks. Doug Becky, what year or years were you over there?
Well, I got there later. I got there in November of 1970. And I remember they put us up in a place to stay, and the bunk beds in there. And there was a warrant officer in there who had landed in Vietnam on his first tour the night that Tet started. And he said that he'd spent his first night in Vietnam clutching his fighting knife, laying underneath his mattress. And I thought, well, is this going to be my future? What's going to happen here? So there's all these unknowns that face you the first few days when you're there.
You must have been questioning, both of you. You touched on it, Dougie, here. Paul Clark, you're wondering. You've been trained. You've been trained to a fine edge, but here you are in an actual combat situation, a combat zone. You're wondering how you're going to stand up or fall down under fire, aren't you? What went through your mind?
It's quite a challenge mentally and emotionally. It's like playing football and practicing all the time. Until you get into a game, you don't really know what you're going to do. And so being a officer and having responsibility for an artillery battery, our guys were required to go out when we got incoming artillery, rockets, and mortars from the enemy to fire back. So they actually had to go face the fire. And I felt it was my responsibility to see what that was like. And I didn't actually wet my pants, but crawled out of the bunker and went out and walked around. The guys, of course, were stunned. Officers and NCOs aren't supposed to be doing this stuff.
You don't have to go out to the fire zone, per se. I mean, where the incoming is coming, and man the howitzers and the rest. But you wrestled with, I read your book, you wrestled with your conscience for a while, didn't you, before you did it?
I didn't know how you could really command people and ask them to do something that you weren't willing to do yourself. On the other hand, I had a wife at home, and I didn't want to put myself in any unnecessary risk, but the decision was made. I went out and did it, and after three or four times, you forgot about it.
What'd the men say when they saw you do this?
I think that it set the tone for the whole time that I was in there in my command.
You will lead from the front then, right?
Absolutely.
They had an officer who would lead from
Absolutely.
The front. Huh? Dougie, what exactly, you were Army Special Forces, so what did that entail?
Well, I was there very late in the war, and most of the Special Forces camps had shut down, and they were starting, the few camps that were left were starting a new mission, which was to train the Cambodian Army. And so we had about a month of preparation, and then the Cambodians started coming in, 500 a month, so we'd have 1,500 at any given time in the camp, and we worked with them and trained them, but, you know, I'll relate one little story that you go out with the Cambodians and you think, oh, they're never griping and they're always cheery and all this. And you see them cackling and talking and stuff like that, but you don't think anything of it. So one day the 101st Airborne came into our sector and they wanted somebody to go out with them. So my hoochmate went out with them, Kent.
Notice the terminology, hoochmate. You better define hooch here so we know what that is.
That's just where you live. That's your roommate. Okay. And so Kent went out with him and he came back in and he was shaking his head. He says, God, I never want to go out with the Americans again. They gripe and they bitch and they moan all the time. And he says, you know, I suppose the Cambodians do that too, but you don't have to listen to it.
They just smile and chatter. And
yeah, you know, I mean, you don't know what they're swearing.
Yeah,
you don't have any idea what they're saying.
Special Forces, Doug. I think Barry Sadler, Green Beret. Did you wear a Green Beret? Were you a part of that?
Well, yeah, that was the uniform.
Well, a lot
that
of people don't know that. We just want to sort that out.
Yeah, that was the uniform.
Okay.
And you didn't wear it in the field. You wore it in the rear. And,
right.
And you wore it when you went to the PX or something, you know, and you strutted around.
Paul, when we got off the plane into, was it Da Nang or wherever you landed the first time into Vietnam, you had the shiny lieutenant bars on the collars of your uniform, your shirt. And but what were you doing with those on? You found out fast you're not supposed to display rank or salute. Is that right?
Oh, my gosh. There was a kind of a pecking order for targets for the enemy, and it started with the CO or any officers, and then it went to the comm guy Sparks, and then went to the medic. And so if the guys weren't too happy with you and they wanted a new commanding officer, they might stand up and salute. So one of the first things we did was to get rid of the bars and the insignia, and everybody did that. The only guy that retained any insignia was the corpsman. He had a Red Cross, and I'm not sure that was so smart, but we couldn't get him under the Geneva Convention to kind of get rid of that. So no saluting, no bars. In fact, I carried a rifle. I didn't want to carry a sidearm because it just pointed to the officers.
Paul Clark, I do believe you carried a shotgun
most of the time. I did carry a shotgun.
12-gauge?
Mm-hmm. It was a 12-gauge. It was a pump, and they used something a little different. They called them flechettes. Mm-hmm. They were like nails with fins on the end that they shot. And I didn't really need, I wasn't going to snipe anybody. I was just concerned if we were attacked to put out as much firepower as I could and
hide. A big hole in a nearby area.
Exactly.
That's what that would do. Paul, we're going to get into your book, Letters Never Written. What an intriguing title. Letters Never Written. We'll define that. We'll get into it. It's quite a story. But Doug, Becky, we need to talk about the new exhibit. It opened in July at the Minnesota Military Museum at Camp Ripley. This is near Little Falls, a couple miles north.
7 miles north of Little Falls.
Okay, it's easy to find.
On the National Guard base.
Right. So when you go through there, there's a brief checkpoint where you show your driver's license and then you go, right?
Show your driver's license, that's it. They're more than happy to have people come up there and tour the museum or visit the base. So they're very open about that.
Very, and Doug has done a grand job of putting together yet another exhibit. Last time I was up there, I saw your Civil War exhibit, a fantastic top-tier exhibit. Now I know you've done the same. I'll get up there shortly to see Minnesota Voices from the Vietnam War. This exhibit opened in mid-July this year. How long will it be up?
It'll be up for about 4 years.
Excellent, good. Mm-hmm. Well, I want you to walk us through it, Douglas, as best you can here. And
it wasn't something that I'd really thought about that much. I'd been to Vietnam, but then I stayed in the reserves, and my time in Vietnam, it was an important time in my life, but it also just became one more event in my life, and my interests as a historian are much more related to World War I and World War II. But General Shelato, who had been the adjutant general and now is the head of the Department of Veterans Affairs in Minnesota, came up to Camp Ripley one time and just mentioned that the 40th anniversary of the end of the fall of Saigon was coming up, and the 50th anniversary of the start of our buildup in 1965 was coming up. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't it be nice to do an exhibit on Vietnam? And, of course, General Shelato was an advisor in Vietnam, too. And so, what can we do for an exhibit? We want to do something different. And so rather than just writing the book or putting the book up and saying all the historical facts or putting up lots of visuals or something, we thought, let's just let Minnesotans speak, and I'll just put out the word and see what veterans will contribute a story about the war in Vietnam. And in the first 2 years of working on the project, I got one or two stories, and I'm starting to get into a panic, and I'm realizing that I'm going to have to go out and really pull it out of people and do interviews. And so I started doing interviews, and then I started haranguing people and calling them up and bugging them and everything, and come on, send me a story. And they started flooding in. And it almost got to the point where I thought, oh, my God, I'm overwhelmed. What am I going to do with all these stories? But they were very good stories. And I have to say that in many cases, they're much more riveting stories. They're better stories than the ones I got out of the World War II veterans.
Wow. Explain that. That's surprising.
I don't know if it's just a generational difference or an education difference or because they're closer to it. I don't know. But they were much more verbal in many cases and much more open in a lot of their experiences.
Mm-hmm. So what started out as a drought became a flood of stories for you.
Interestingly, though, when I do the World War II generation, I'd usually start out asking them about their childhood. And they usually love to talk a lot about the Depression and their childhood and things growing up, their growing up years. Mm-hmm. And then that would lead into World War II and their experience.
Depression shaped their lives.
That's right.
In many ways, the people...
As did the war.
Right, yeah. Absolutely. So we have the exhibit up and running now, Minnesota Voices from the Vietnam War. And Doug, as we go along this noon hour, I'd like you to share, if you could, at least pieces of some of the stories you've collected here. We're going to take a break here. It's 12:21 right now. We have 84 so weltering degrees, humid degrees, in the Twin Cities. Take a break. Back with more on the Vietnam War. Minnesota Voices from that war right after this.
Jaime's Haberdashery presents the Jaime's Oath.
On my honor, I will dress my best, be clean in my speech and actions, live my life honestly, take care of my body for good build and fit, to help keep my country strong by supporting local merchants. Through the words and actions of my haberdasher, I will trust.
So, gentlemen, will you take the Jaime's Oath? Jaime's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street, downtown St. Paul, at Jaime's.com.
The Stillwater area is most fortunate to be the home of Valley Bookseller, located right on Main Street in downtown. If you or anyone you know likes to read, this is the bookstore for you. Books, book clubs, book specials, book events, and more books. Check out their website at valleybookseller.com to see events, special sales, and staff recommendations. Call 651-430-3385. Valley Bookseller. Great books. Great people. 217 Main Street North, Stillwater.
Back in the late 1800s, if your brewery burned to the ground, it usually meant you were out of business for good. But Joseph Wolf rebuilt his brewery and continued brewing his beer until Prohibition hit. And a 93-year dry spell isn't stopping great granddaughters Pat and Kathy from bringing it back. Go to wolfbrewing.com, click on Beer Finder so you can bring it back to your home. Ask for Wolf's. Stillwater's original craft beer. Wolf Brewing Company, Stillwater, Minnesota.
Mississippi Dunes is golf in a country club atmosphere that's open to the public. Mississippi Dunes is a beautiful link-style course on 3,000 feet of Mississippi River shoreline with natural prairie, abundant wildlife, and century-old majestic trees. Quiet and serene, each hole is surrounded by nature, not a line of houses. Strategically designed under the tenets of Dr. Alistair McKenzie, Mississippi Dunes is just 15 minutes south of St. Paul and Cottage Grove. For directions and to book a tee time, go to MississippiDunes.com.
Hello, we're back here. Stan Turner with you. Thank you so much for your company on this hot, hot day. I have something of a hot topic, too, one that's not going to go away, nor should it. We're talking about the Vietnam War, especially, most especially, the Minnesotans in that conflict, that terribly unpopular conflict, will always be the subject of debate. We honor the soldiers who were sent over, who did the fighting, who did the dying, and all of that, and those who survived and came back carry the scars, both psychological and physical, and we need to honor them and hear their stories. And we have two Vietnam vets with us in studio this noon, both of whom are doing excellent work at keeping the story alive, telling the story, drawing out stories from other veterans as well. Doug Becky, who is curator of the Minnesota Military Museum, who has mounted a new exhibit called Minnesota Voices from the Vietnam War, and a Marine Corps veteran from Minnesota, now from Minnesota, Letters Never Written, the name of his book, South Vietnam 1968, Captain P.G. Clark. That would be Paul Clark. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us today. Doug, we were talking about you extracting these stories from at first kind of reluctant folks, the Vietnam vets. Were probably not all that crazy about reliving that terrible conflict. You were in it. But boy, what was a drought became a flood as more and more guys said, yeah, I think I'll do it. I'll definitely tell you my stories. And I'd like you, if you could, to share with us a few of the anecdotes, a few of the pieces of these stories, so we can get a sense of what these guys went through.
Okay, well, they're not all guys. And the first story...
That's a very important point.
Yeah,
thank you.
The first story I've got is from an Army nurse. And you think about these young women, they're 23 years old, and they have usually a couple of guys working for them that are 19, 20, 21 years old. And they have to deal with all the debris of the battlefield and some horrific stuff. So this is one from an Army nurse and 91st Evacuation Hospital in Da Nang, 1970 and 71. And she's talking about a Loach pilot. A Loach was a small reconnaissance helicopter, and Loach pilots had a reputation for being absolutely crazy. They were very quiet. They'd go in and out between the trees, and they'd find the enemy. A Loach pilot got hit in the leg, and by the time he landed on our helipad at Quang Tri, I have no idea how he made it because he was bleeding out so bad because he couldn't lay down. He was having seizure activity, which means he was not getting much oxygen to his brain, and it was my job that day to hang blood for his case. And he went to what we call our ICU unit in those days. I didn't stop at the chapel a lot to pray. I usually did my devotions in my own room, but I did stop that day because I was mad at God. And I prayed that he would die because I didn't want to send another person home who wouldn't recognize his family. Just take him out of his misery and let him die. The next day, Dr. Newman had me go to the ICU, and he sat me down in a chair and he told me this young pilot, this nurse really worked hard on you, and he thought you were going to be brain dead. And he had him do some math to show me that he didn't have any brain damage. He made the kid talk to me. And it was like God had said, Mary, you never decide who lives and who dies in this war. You just do the best you can, and that's all you can do.
Oh, can we give her last name?
Mary Breed.
Mary Breed. I'm wondering if she's part of the nurse contributions to a book published about 5 years ago called Sisterhood of War.
She is, yeah.
Minnesota Women in Vietnam.
She's part of that.
She's part of this. Mm-hmm. Published by the Minnesota Historical Society Press. And it was put together by Kim Heikela, who was not a combat nurse, but in whom these nurses trust. They trusted Kim 100% to write the book, to tell the true story. If I may, just a quick side story here. When Mary and her sister nurses were with me in this very studio talking about that book, Sisterhood of War, they were so overwrought by their emotions after all those years that I think it was Mary who had to get up, go out here, and walk up and down the hall for a while in the station here just to decompress a little bit. Those wounds are still raw, and like you say, Doug, they suffered as much as anybody did.
Yeah.
Go ahead with more stories.
This one's from Marine Reconnaissance, and the title of it is Cat and Mouse, Reconnaissance Insertion, Cat and Mouse. So it got to the point in the north where there's only a few landing zones where they could bring in the helicopters, and so they do mock landings. And then at one point, they jump out and run into the underbrush, and then the first thing they'd have to do is hide. So this veteran I've known for 30 years, and we served in the reserves together. He eventually retired as an Army Sergeant Major. Probably the most horrendous memories that I have of Vietnam are the time periods during those first few hours when you're getting set off, when you're sitting off the edge of a steep ridgeline in a tiny little 360-degree enclave. Just the six of you, and you're doing the best you can to hide. Now, they've just been inserted, and so the North Vietnamese are starting to look for them. You've moved all the crushed brush back off the trail you came in on, and then you watch the North Vietnamese teams walking up and down the trail looking for you, sometimes only a few feet away. Of all the Vietnam nightmares I have, those are probably the worst ones. I'm watching the NVA guys come by and look right at them. And you see them so clearly, even their eyes, and they don't see you. It's just such a mind-boggling, tense feeling to be in that horribly vulnerable position, 5, 6, 7 feet away, nowhere to go, just stuck, waiting to be found and killed. And, you know, it sounds like, how can this happen? But I know when I walked through the jungle, when you're moving, you're watching out for the branch that's going to be snapped back in front of you. You're watching out where you're putting your feet. You're looking at all kinds of things. And I remember one day, one of my first times in the field there, realizing how absolutely vulnerable I was, how people could be sitting off in the bushes not very far away training their rifle on me, and I'm completely vulnerable. All they have to do is lay there and watch me, and I'm worried about the branches and the ants and the things that I might be stepping on. Mm-hmm. And Floyd wrote this story, and it summarizes it from the other side, though.
You said walking, worrying about the next footstep. You did worry about that because landmines were all over.
Tripwires, landmines.
Tripwires. Yeah. Paul, we're going to get back to more of your stories that you've collected, Doug, for the exhibit at the Minnesota Military Museum. Paul Clark, the Marine Corps, what Doug was just reading, that struck home, what he experienced.
Oh, my gosh.
You were right there.
You know, it's just, the jungle is so close. And you're concerned about stepping on a punji stick or falling into a pit, and there's animals, and everything's got thorns on it, and you're trying to be quiet, and you make your way. You like to pretend like you're invisible when you go through, and you kind of ignore the threat because there's nothing you can do about it but do your best.
The truth is, you're high profile. They're watching you. They can see you, can't they?
They can, but it's very close. You know, we talked about carrying a shotgun.
Yes.
You can't see very far in the jungle. So you need to, if you have an issue, you just kind of spray everything around and try and find a hole to crawl in and pull it over you.
Paul, you a Chicago boy before you went off to the war. You married a Minnesota lady, Gretchen.
Very lucky.
Right. You were married. Mm. She was lucky, too. you married before you went overseas. And you would write her letters. Yet, the name of your book is Letters Never Written. Can you please square that for us, sir? What exactly does that mean?
Well, I wrote this book about 4 years ago. And it took 40 years for me to sit down and really talk about what happened over there. I wanted my wife, Gretchen, and my sons and grandchildren to know what I went through. And because I never told them in the letters, what's the point of telling them that we're under attack or so-and-so got blown away or we don't have any food or whatever? They can't do anything about it, and all they do is worry. So not only were the letters sanitized for fear of being captured, you couldn't tell anybody your mission or where you were or what you were doing, but then again, there's no point in telling them. So the letters went something like this. Oh, it's really, really nice out today. A little humid. We're going to get some rain. And food was okay. I met some guy from Colorado, and we talked about the Rocky Mountains. And
what's really going on when you're writing
this?
What's
really going on?
What's
we're
going
hiding
on?
In the bunker,
yep.
You know.
You're under
and
fire.
We're under fire. And
the food is terrible if you have any at all.
Yeah. So
your clothes are filthy dirty. The whole place stinks. You're waiting to die any minute, aren't you? I mean, just
well,
about.
Well, I think that the expectation that I had when I went over is I probably wouldn't come back. And I thought if I started with that, that anything above that was a plus. So, but you do your best, and you're not in control. We were sent over there. No one wanted to be there. My goodness gracious. And you were sent over, and you had a bond together. Fortunately for me, I was with a great group of guys. It was the best team that I had ever been on, and everybody had everybody's back, and we made it together.
Courage. I want to ask both of you, definition of courage. You both are combat vets. What is it, Hemingway, who said the definition of courage is grace under pressure? What's your definition, Paul?
Boy, I don't know. I think that you need to push yourself to do what you think is the right thing, as we talked about going out and leading the people and doing what you ask them to do and to do it under fire.
And you're scared, aren't you?
Of course.
Well, that's it.
Of course.
Anybody who says
terrible.
Right.
But you overcome it, and then it's kind of funny. You become your environment. And the more that you do things like this, the less difficult it is.
So, Paul, you sanitized your letters home, talked about the weather, talked about the food, talked about all those innocuous things. So it was after the war, long after, that you reconstructed the real nitty-gritty, the down-and-dirty stuff of combat, right?
It was, and it was all from memory. I didn't have a diary. I didn't have any the photographs were all damaged. In fact, you can look at this one photograph on the front of the book, and when I brought it over to Kathleen over at the Valley Booksellers to see if she wanted to carry it, she said, well, this one's all dirty. I said, what are all the... I said, that's the way we got the film back. They got... You couldn't take film over there, and it got all moldy and everything. So I didn't have any of that information. And I just did it by memory, and then when I got back, Gretchen had saved all the letters. So I looked at them, and of course, those sanitized letters at least gave me some idea of where I was when.
Okay, Doug, we're going to have you give us some more of your stories here. We're going to bounce back and forth between you two guys. It's the same war, the same shared experience. Why don't you tell us more?
Well, there's
of the stories we're going to be able to see when we go to the Minnesota Military Museum, the Minnesota Voices from Vietnam War.
All kinds of stories come in, and some of them, a lot of them are humorous, and a lot of people wrote stories about their pets. And I had a dog in Vietnam, and I loved my dog, and that's another story. But this is from a Special Forces NCO. Think fast. We were at B-24 in Con Tum. We had to go to Ben Het. We checked in to see if the Arvin had made the morning sweep of the road for mines. After being told the road had been swept, we departed. Paul was driving and I was riding shotgun. We were moving at a fast speed. As we rounded a curve in the road, out of the bush came 5 or 6 yards. That's mountain yards. They all had AKs, which meant they were Viet Cong. Yeah, they were the enemy.
All right.
They were holding them by the barrel and resting them on their shoulders. They saw us the same time we saw them. Paul yelled, "Uncle Eddie, what should we do?" I said, "Floor the gas and wave," which we both did, and the yards waved back.
Floor the gas and waved at the enemy and got out.
Things happen. Yeah, things happen.
Would that happen to the Marine Corps, huh, Paul?
I don't remember those, but it was a good strategy.
But, you know, I heard very similar stories from World War II situations.
Sure.
Tell one of those real quick.
Please do.
This is an officer was driving in the Jeep, and they were in a confined area, and they were coming up to a corner in an urban area. They had to go around a corner, and there was no place to go. They could only go forward, and as they went around the corner, here came a German Jeep with an officer and a driver in it. And they both stopped, and they looked at each other. The German officer stood up and saluted. He stood up and saluted, and both Jeeps backed away.
I'm pretty sure that nobody wanted to be in that war.
What do you do? And the situation with the Jeeps here. So anybody that's gone camping knows about insects.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, the elephant grass was 7 feet tall, with those wispy tops of them lashing my face. My forearms were cut and bleeding from the razor edges of the grass. It was hotter than the hinges of hell. My jungle fatigues are black with sweat. Wait a minute, my hand is cut. Wait a minute, my face is cut. Wait a minute, my booze is caught. It was wild. Suddenly there was an encounter with a vile creature known as a red ant. They have a sting about a third as painful as a bee sting, but one's never bitten by just one red ant. These devils make big balls out of the leaves and hang from the trees. Inside these balls are thousands of ants. Then an unsuspecting GI nudges one of these, say, with his helmet. Well, first there are dozens, then there are hundreds. They were in my ears, they were in my helmet, they were in my hair, down my back, in my crotch, down my pant legs, in my socks, all the time biting living whatever out of me.
We get the sense of that. Yeah.
Yeah, the helmet went one direction, the rifle went another, the machete in another. Off came my rucksack, then my TA-50, off with the fatigues, all the while swatting, cursing, hopping, jumping, stripping naked down to my boots and socks, not caring if the enemy was in the area or not. I was doing the frigging Watutsi for all I was good for. And, you know, that's one of the things I mentioned earlier. You're walking in the jungle, and you're not looking at the enemy all the time. You're looking for things like this. I had a branch snap and a red ant drop on me one time. And, you know,
Paul, how'd you get along with the ants over there?
Oh, my gosh. There were insects everywhere, and it was pretty sanitized in our little positions after everybody's tromping around.
Mm-hmm.
Never was out, never had an ant attack, but centipedes would be, and millipedes, maybe a foot and a half long.
How about snakes?
Oh, my God. We drove over a snake one time with a deuce and a half. It was at least 12 feet long and about 6 feet around, and it just kept going.
They just kept.
There's a lot of poisonous snakes because of the vipers.
Good Lord. What a hell, I'll tell you. Mm-hmm. We'll get more stories. In fact, I want to read, if I may, Paul, from your book on one here. This is the bad stuff, because that's what it is. You can't sanitize war. It's ugly. You write this. "Now the attack is over, and I'm returning from the medevac chopper." That would be the helicopter that took out the wounded, right? Okay. "We took a few casualties this time. One kid, Murphy, is messed up pretty badly," and I'm sanitizing your language a little bit because I have to, because you're telling it like it was. "So one kid really badly shot up. We move him onto a stretcher, and my hand sticks to his with the drying blood. It wants me to come along. I hold his hand. The hand wants me to come along. I hold it tightly as the stretcher jerks its way to the chopper. His left eye is missing, and his stomach lies open. I am beyond feeling. We are used to all this, desensitized by the magnitude of injuries, the deaths and deprivations. Everyone just moves on. By tonight, we'll be focusing on tonight, and today will dim and be forgotten. Maybe there's some sort of mind medicine." Paul?
That was incredible. Can you read the next chapter there, Stan? The next paragraph?
Yeah, I can.
It's this was probably my worst memory.
As we reach the chopper, as we reach the chopper, dust stings our eyes and grit grinds in our mouths. The propeller wash buffets our bodies back and forth like grass in a storm. Murphy's good eye looks at me and he says, "USOB. Why did you do this to me?"
He's right. You know, we were responsible for these kids. I felt a great deal of responsibility. And although I knew that I was doing my job and I did the best I could, and I knew that Murph was under pressure and hurt and hurting inside, that message has stayed with me my whole life. And
Paul,
I still
your,
feel that
it
responsibility.
It wasn't your fault. He knew that, and you know that. You know what happened to him? Did he survive?
I don't know. One of the things that at least happened with me is I don't remember most of the guys, and I haven't followed up.
Okay.
You kind of move on, and you're afraid to get to know them too well because they may be gone the next minute.
Doug Becky and our friend Paul Clark here reliving a horrible time in their lives. We're going to continue with this, all this in conjunction with Paul Clark's book, Letters Never Written, South Vietnam, 1968, Captain P.G. Clark, U.S. Marine Corps, and the new exhibit at the Minnesota Military Museum, Minnesota Voices from the Vietnam War. It's now up there for your perusal. I hope you go up there to Camp Ripley and take it in. We'll be right back.
Hymie's Haberdashery presents The Hymie's Oath.
On my honor, I will dress my best, be clean in my speech and actions, live my life honestly, take care of my body for good build and fit, to help keep my country strong by supporting local merchants. Through the words and actions of my haberdasher, I will trust.
So, gentlemen, will you take the Hymie's Oath? Hymie's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street, downtown St. Paul, at Hymie's.com.
Computer Repair and Services is well known for simple pricing and excellent customer service. That's one of the reasons we are the oldest computer repair business in the area. Computers are the specialty, but they also repair tablets and phones like iPhones and Nooks. That's right, Computer Repair and Services is your one stop for technology. If it's not repairable, it can be recycled for free. Computer Repair and Services, located on Highway 5 in Stillwater. Click with confidence and call 439-7544. That's 651-439-7544.
The Stillwater area is most fortunate to be the home of Valley Bookseller, located right on Main Street in downtown. If you or anyone you know likes to read, this is the bookstore for you. Books, book clubs, book specials, book events, and more books. Check out their website at valleybookseller.com to see events, special sales, and staff recommendations. Call 651-430-3385. Valley Bookseller. Great books. Great people. 217 Main Street North, Stillwater.
Wolf Beer in the Bottle isn't just another bottled beer. Why? Remove the cork to find out. Yes, that's real cork. Now pour. Taste. The Strong Golden is a Belgian-style ale featuring local honey from the valley, chamomile, and rose hips. Are you ready to enjoy? Go to wolfbrewing.com and click on Beer Finder. Then ask for Wolf's. Stillwater's original craft beer. Wolf Brewing Company, Stillwater, Minnesota.
We are back here. We are back here. Our final segment. Boy, this hour is flying by. We're talking about the Minnesotans and the Vietnam War. We have two Minnesota Vietnam War vets with us, Doug Becky and Paul Clark. Paul of the Marine Corps and Doug with Special Forces, U.S. Army. And Doug has put together a fantastic exhibit. You need to see. The whole family needs to. Yes, bring the kids, too. They need to learn. Minnesota Voices from the Vietnam War, now on at the Minnesota Military Museum at Camp Ripley. That's just a bit north of Little Falls. You won't have any trouble finding it. And Paul Clark, author of Letters Never Written. Well, there are letters that finally did get put down in the covers of a book here. His combat experiences as a Marine. Paul, you were up in what they call I Corps, which was the northernmost part of South Vietnam near the so-called DMZ, the demilitarized zone between North and South Vietnam, right?
It was, and it ran from the South China Sea over to Laos. It was an artificial kind of a 10-mile boundary between North and South Vietnam. Of course, we weren't allowed to militarize it, but the North Vietnamese moved on down through it, and part of our strategy was to build a series of outposts along there where we would impede them from entering to the South.
All right.
And then, as we talked earlier, we'd set on these outposts, and the C-130s had come across, and spray us with Agent Orange in order to defoliate between the different areas.
Spray with Agent Orange to defoliate the jungle, clear it out so you can see the enemy. Did you know at the time it was a cancer-causing agent, Agent Orange?
No, I don't. I don't know, but I have to believe that the government didn't know either. I can't believe they would have done that if really? Oh, I see some disbelief.
Well, I'm saying, who knows?
It was a commonly used herbicide. It was used all over the United States.
Yeah.
So used all over farms.
So you had these droplets on your skin of Agent Orange, and I assume in later years you have had yourself tested.
Every vet that's been in that area does that. It wasn't. Now, we were warned. We knew they were going to spray. So we would go into a bunker or tent or whatever it is. But then the problem is you come out and walk around on the ground at night, you take your shoes off, and you touch everything, and it's all over everything. So a lot of guys have gotten it and passed.
Doug Beckie, you have so many stories. We could do 5 hours at least and still have many stories left over you've collected for your exhibit. Please share at least some snippets of other stories.
This is one Marine's reason why he went in the service, why he went in the Marines. February of 1966, I was a student at the University of Minnesota, and one of the young guys that I went to school with for 12 years was severely wounded in Vietnam. I was walking across the University of Minnesota campus, and I saw that the Students' Union was taking blood donations for Vietnam. So I walked over, and to my surprise, it was a Socialist Students' Union. They were taking blood donations to be sent to North Vietnam to fight the American aggressors. And I'm kind of tunnel-visioned, and all I could think of was Lyle, the person that was wounded, and I was tremendously upset. What do you say to these students? So I canceled out of school, I drove to downtown St. Paul, and I went in the Marine Corps recruiting office, and I enlisted in the Marine Corps. Incidentally, by the time he got to Vietnam, the guy who had been wounded had recovered and was back at the unit, and they served in the same unit.
Oh, amazing. I had never heard that story, Doug,
about
gathering blood for the North.
This is another one?
Yes, please.
Okay, jungle rot. My friends who served in the Highland and stayed out for 30 days at a time laughed at us because we came back in. This is the 9th Division down in the Delta. They laughed at us because we came back in to sleep at our base camp most nights. But they stayed high and dry. The Delta was neither high nor dry. Every day the medics conducted foot examinations of the troops for jungle rot, an officially incapacitating condition caused by the insidious stamp. Occasionally we would stay overnight, but doing so promoted the rot. Once we stayed out two nights, more than 75% of the platoon was incapacitated.
Jungle rot, Paul?
We had it when you had the monsoons.
Yeah.
And we were traveling.
What does it do to your feet? What happens?
I'm sorry?
What does it do to your feet?
It kind of looks like what I would imagine leprosy looks like.
Oh, my.
Your skin all, first it gets wrinkled and bunches up and gets soft, and then it falls off, and then you have sores, and then it turns black, and then you can't walk, and you can't use whatever part has been exposed. So it does incapacitate you.
Doug, maybe another story or two, Ken?
This is from a guy that served in the rear area, we tell a lot of combat stories and everything, but the vast majority of people that were in Vietnam served in the rear. They served in a logistical system or the medical system, something. When I arrived at the 90th Replacement Battalion at Long Binh, I was pulled and sent to an air-conditioned 1st Logistical Headquarters to work as an E-5 personnel specialist responding to congressional inquiries. When I told them I couldn't type because all of my training was on the job, they didn't believe me, and they gave me a letter to type. Then they believed me. As I was waiting for transportation later that day to my next assignment at the Benoit Army Post, I asked an enlisted cadre if he knew what it was like there. He took me to the second story of the barracks and pointed to a post far off in the distance. I asked what it was like there, and he told me they didn't know, but at night they'd sit up on the upper stairs, drink beer, and watch the place get mortared. He was right, and this was my reward for not knowing how to type.
Oh. Well, a few laughs to be had, probably a very few. But anything else, Doug, you want to share with us?
Well, there's a million of them.
There are, and you can see them. You can see them.
Yeah.
You can see many of them. I suppose you don't have room to post all of them up there, but do you have them on a website?
They're all posted.
They're all there.
It's like a crazy quilt in this room with stories, and it kind of violates a basic tenet of museum exhibits that you don't put too much type up. And I had people say to me, oh, you're putting up too much type. And I thought, I worried to myself, oh, I'm putting up too much type. But everyone that goes into it finds it to be very engrossing.
But you do have the artifacts of war there as well.
Artifacts are there, photographs. I get pictures from these people, so you can see their faces. You can see the places they were in, along with the stories.
Did you guys, were you fully aware of the protests going on in this country when you were in Vietnam fighting? Did you know the extent of the anti-war fervor in this country?
I guess we were aware that the war wasn't popular. Of course, it wasn't popular with us either. We wanted to be home. And it was difficult. I know that when we came back, which was kind of interesting, I call it in the book sneaking back home, because when we landed in San Francisco, we were given quite a lecture and briefing. Don't wear a uniform, don't carry your sea bag, don't make a scene, and don't talk to anybody. And the people were very, very upset about it. It's kind of unfortunate. Today, I think we honor our servicemen. We realize it's the politicians that send them there, and it's not the guys that are in the trenches.
Amen. Absolutely right. Doug, how about that?
I came home on leave from the 82nd Airborne Division before I went to Vietnam in May of 1970, and the campus at the university was in turmoil because of Kent State. And I walked around, and I was a couple years out of high school, and I saw the people that I'd gone to high school with, and they were very straight-laced in high school. We had dress codes and everything. And they didn't look that way anymore. Times had changed. And on the steps of Northrop were all kinds of speakers praising Ho Chi Minh, praising Mao, praising Lenin, damning every aspect of the United States. And then all around the mall were young ladies who in World War II would have been donut dollies or supporting the troops somehow, asking me to sign petitions condemning the nation and condemning the country and condemning the war in Vietnam. And so as a young soldier, I felt that my generation was at war with me, and I'm going to go to war with my generation. And I went to Vietnam with that attitude, and when the time came to come home, I didn't know if I wanted to come home. And I thought maybe I'd get discharged to Australia, where I'd had a fantastic R&R in Vietnam, mm-hmm. or I mean in Australia. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I came back to Seattle, and Seattle was a much more tranquil place for soldiers to arrive in. But I was strutting. I had my beret on. I had my jump boots on, and I'm 6'2", and I was going to look belligerent. And everybody was very nice to me. Everyone was very friendly, cooperative. I carried two Viet Cong rifles home on the airplane with me. Nobody batted an eye.
On the airplane.
Souvenir rifles, nobody batted an eye. And I got home. I landed in Minneapolis. And as soon as I got off the plane, there was a guy standing there, probably 50-ish, handing out leaflets. And I thought, oh, here it is already. I can't even barely get off the plane, and the protesters are here. And he came up to me, tried to hand me a leaflet. I pushed him aside and cursed at him something. He came running after me. No, you don't understand. You don't understand. We've opened up a servicemen center here at the airport. Can we help you get a taxi? Do you need to make a phone call? You need a cup of coffee? Is there anything we can do? So I felt about a 16th of an inch tall, and I really didn't have any bad experiences coming home, but I did talk to a number of guys who had bad experiences specifically around San Francisco.
Right. Okay, mm-hmm. just as you mentioned, Paul. Doug, injured when you were in Vietnam? Were you?
I was not. Okay. No, I was not.
Paul, you were.
I got hit by a mortar and other little minor things, but I'm here. I'm happy.
You are. Let me ask you about your sleeping after you got home, getting through the night. Bothered by dreams, flashbacks of horror scenes in combat?
It was extremely difficult for me, and I think that most of the guys went through this. You hear a loud noise, you jump up and hide underneath the bed, and of course my wife wondered what the hell was going on. But gradually you get into civilian life and you just put it behind you and move on, and every day it became less and less, and after a couple of years, at least in my case, I pretty much forgot about it.
Mm-hmm. But you did have some bad nights then, didn't you?
Yeah.
Coming back. How about now? Still hitting it?
When I wrote the book a couple years ago, I felt very good about it. I thought it was actually kind of cathartic.
Mm-hmm. Cathartic. Yep. Gotcha.
And but it wasn't.
Yeah.
It just opened some old wounds, and since then it's been a little more difficult, but it's getting better. Hopefully after this program today, I won't be put back on the,
I hope so
on the
too.
Old track.
Where do we get your book, Paul Clark? Letters Never Written, South Vietnam, 1968. Where do we
get it? Well, you can get it right across the street at Valley Booksellers. Kathleen is very good about supporting local authors. It's also available on Amazon.
Okay. So, folks, it is available to you. And, Doug, your exhibit is up and running there.
It is? That's right, yes.
These terms used by the military in Vietnam, I suppose some of them are still in use, but you provide a glossary, Paul, in the back of your book. Some of them are rather poignant. Some are pretty funny, too. some of them are not. Random here. Flak jacket and helmet, of course, your
sure.
best heavy and unwieldy,
well,
and they'd save your life.
Well... When they worked.
When they worked.
If they got hit in the right place with the right bullet, you're okay.
What they say about a parachute, if it doesn't work, bring it back.
They were cumbersome. So I put the glossary back there because I didn't want to interrupt the story mm-hmm. with all of these terms that the military uses. My gosh, we have acronyms for everything.
Yep. Yep. Some of which we can actually use on the air. How about the term gunny? What was gunny?
That's a gunnery sergeant. Okay. He's the guy that actually ran the unit. I mean,
wait a minute. There are officers and there are non-commissioned officers. So I know the story here. Sergeants run the Army, do they, and the Marine Corps?
And in the Marine Corps, the sergeants run the Marine Corps, too. They really are the heart and soul of any unit. I mean, the officers provide some discipline and umbrella and overall strategy, but... The sergeant.
Our friend Becky here has an interesting smirk on his face. What about that sergeant, huh?
Well, I mean, there's, you know, as in any organization, there's good people and there's people that need counseling and work. And, you know, in the military, you get good sergeants and you get good officers and you get bad sergeants and you get bad officers. Yeah. And you know, but you pull together as a team and hopefully the strong people rise to the top and get everybody through it.
Doug, Becky, the term John Wayne, what does that mean? Did you ever,
Well, I suppose it means someone who tries to be a hero.
Oh, okay. And, that's part of it, but there's another definition,
too. And the other part of it is this little key that you use to open your C rations with is what we used. And it,
P-38. We just call
them
P-38.
So that's the technical term.
I still got one on my key ring.
So you call them P-38 now.
P-38, yeah.
That was a fire plane in World War II.
No, it's a P-38.
P-38 Lightning, okay, or a John
Wayne. I know lots of guys that still have them on their key rings.
Okay. I got to ask you this, and I've known this term for a long time, fragged. Well, it's a downer.
I'm going to read this because it might be a little bit better well said. Most officers were exceptional. However, a very small portion just didn't measure up under combat conditions. Understand that everybody's life was at stake if the CO didn't do his job properly. In rare occasions, these officers who put everyone at unreasonable risk would become injured by an accidental discharge of a fragmentation grenade.
Accidental, you say. Well, Dougie?
It happens in all wars. Yeah. It happens in all situations. Mm-hmm. Can I just read one coming home story here? This is a parent's relief. Mm-hmm. My tour of duty in Vietnam was finally over in October of 1968, and I was on my way back to America. Landing in Tacoma, Washington, all of the soldiers on the plane cheered very loudly as the plane touched down on good old American soil. It was then that I realized how lucky I was to have made it back alive. The next thing I did was call my mom. She was working as a cook at Ellsworth High School. I remember my mom's friend, Joan, the secretary, answering the phone and saying, "Just a minute," as she ran to get my mom to the phone. When mom picked up the phone, for a very brief period of time, there was a pause, and then I knew she was crying and happy to have her son back alive from Vietnam. I, too, had tears in my eyes and was very happy to be back in the States.
Amen. What a way to end the show. Thank you so much, Doug Becky and Paul Clark. Thank you so much, folks. Thank you for being with us. We'll see you Monday on the All Request Show. Thank you. Have a great weekend. Bye-bye.